Hello and welcome once again to this series of podcasts brought to you by Kilkenny Library Services in partnership with the Government's Decadent Centenaries Fund and Kilkenny County Council. My name is Owen Swinton Welsh, and in these podcasts we focus on Revolutionary Era Kilkenny. In today's podcast I will examine the Sinis Cross Ambush, which took place in the far south of the county in the townland of Tubbers in the parish of Munkhine on Saturday afternoon, the 18th of June 1921. Notably, the Sinis Cross ambush took place just 2 hours after the Crown Forces had surprised a planned IRA ambush at the other end of the county at Coolbawn near Castlecomer, where two column members were killed. Both events happening in the Kilkenny IRA Brigade at the same time was just a coincidence. Local companies were pretty much left to their own devices in regards to planning and initiating ambushes. However, it certainly was a morale boost the Kilkenny Brigade needed after events in Castlecomer. That's because the Sinis Cross ambush, instigated by the 9th Battalion Kilkenny IRA, was deemed a success from the IRA's viewpoint. Indeed, in purely militaristic terms, it was one of the only successful textbook ambushes during the War of Independence in County Kilkenny. What I mean by this is that there was a set strategy which was effectively executed according to the plans drawn up. Also, the Crown Forces came along the route as expected and were totally surprised. They were not informed in any way about the ambush. In addition, the Crown Forces had two casualties, including one fatality, while the IRA had no casualties and the entire group managed to escape without being captured. A much sought-after rifle was also captured by the IRA, so it ticked all the boxes from that perspective. I should state from the outset that three of my granduncles, my grandfather Bill Welch's brothers, so that's James, Pat and Michael Welch, were part of the ambush that day. My granddad was only 10 years old, so he didn't take part. So I have skin in the game, so to speak, but I will attempt to remain as unbiased as humanly possible. So just to set the context of what was happening in deep south County Kilkenny at this time, there had not been a whole lot of activity, militarily speaking, although there had been very strong support for the political side of things, such as the Dáil Loan fundraising initiative. Munkhine Parish itself had initially been in the 6th IRA Battalion, headquartered in Tullaher. This was a fair distance away, so in February 1921, just 4 months before the Sinis Cross ambush, the 9th Kilkenny Battalion was formed, which was headquartered in Munkhine. It stretched as far as Kilmacow and Slieve parishes. The leader of the battalion, or OC as it was known, officer commanding, was Jack McCullough Welch of Portnascully Mills near Carrageen, Munkhine. Thus, as the highest ranking IRA man in the area, he subsequently was in overall charge of the Sinis Cross ambush on that day. By the way, at this stage of the War of Independence in Ireland, there was much less targets for the IRA to attack. Lots of RIC barracks had been closed down and subsequently burned down, of course. This is what occurred to Munkhine Barracks, which was destroyed in May 1920 after the RIC had evacuated. It was located where the present Garda station is in the village, if anyone knows it. So there was only really two targets left near the 9th Battalion area for the IRA to attack. That was the RIC barracks in Fadown in Town Parish and the barracks in Kilmacow. To attack these buildings though directly at this stage of the conflict was a bit pointless. The remaining barracks were strongly fortified with steel shutters in all the windows and doors, barbed wires around the buildings, and with the Crown Forces inside having much superior weapons than the IRA possessed. So the only real way to attack the Crown Forces was when they left the barracks on patrols. It should be noted, in fairness to the revolutionaries from this area, that there had been three previous attempts to attack the Fadown RIC during the previous 6 months. In January 1921, the Munkhine IRA tried to attack the barracks from outside with no success. In April 1921, the West Kilkenny Flying Column tried to ambush an RIC patrol on the Fadown to Piltown Road at Dowley's of Beach Farm, but the patrol never came, having been tipped off. The column were lucky to escape with their lives, having nearly become surrounded on the Besborough Domain. People would know that estate today as Kildalton Agricultural College, but they managed to break through the military cordon and get away. On the third attempt, in May 1921, that's just a few weeks before Sinis Cross, the Piltown IRA led by Jack Duggan of Belline waited at the home of the Fadown RIC sergeant, keeping his wife and children locked inside. The sergeant usually travelled to his house to visit his wife with a bodyguard escort for about an hour every morning. However, the IRA left early and it was believed their position was compromised. So the Sinis Cross ambush was the fourth real attempt to attack the Fadown RIC, the majority of whom were black and tans. These black and tans were sent to Fidown during the course of the previous year to augment the small number of Irish RIC police who were in the barracks originally. So for those that don't know the area, Sinis Cross is located about 5 kilometres from Fidown Barracks in the townland of Tubbers, Munkine. That's not to be confused with the Tubbers in Urlingford Tullerone. Townland names like Tubbers or Tubber are quite common generally, and the name stems from the Irish for well, lots of these being holy wells, which are quite common around Kilkenny. Now, it was well known to the locals from this part of Munkine that a cycle patrol of black and tans often left Fidown Barracks in the morning and cycled to Clogger Creamery in Munkine Parish, passing through Sinis Cross along the way. At the creamery, they rendezvoused with their comrades from Kilmacow RIC Barracks, who cycled from the opposite direction. They would chat for a while, smoke a few cigarettes, before returning back to their respective barracks. This was considered the perfect opportunity to attack the Crown Forces. And just a little note on RIC cycle patrols. In some parts of Ireland, RIC cycle patrols were stopped as they were considered too dangerous as it exposed the Crown Forces too much. Thus, lorries were used for patrols. However, by the spring of 1921, many RIC stations reverted back to cycle patrols. The main reason being that roads were trenched and dug up far and wide to impede the movement of Crown Forces in their motorised vehicles. Large trees were another option used by the IRA. You just had to cut down a tree to block the road and perhaps even funnel the Crown Forces in a direction you wanted them to go. By and large, in 1921, most locals didn't have the luxury of motorised vehicles, so they were able to pass these blockages on the road as they travelled on foot or by bike, while people travelling by horse and traps could easily move around the obstruction by getting into a field and bypassing the trenches and fallen trees that way. So it wasn't a huge inconvenience for the general population all in all. What all this meant was that Crown Forces reverted back to using their bicycles as the best means of transport. Okay, so the big strategic negative was that the bicycles would not offer them the same level of protection if attacked than a lorry would, but there was a number of clear advantages for the Crown Forces to be using bikes. Bicycles allowed them to move more freely and get beyond any blockages they may encounter. They also offered one other big benefit in that it was possible to move around relatively quietly. The engine of a lorry could be heard from miles around, it being in a fairly uncommon sound in 1921 Ireland. This was not the case with the humble bicycle, so there was much benefits to it from a Crown Forces perspective, surprisingly. Now, it appears that plans for the ambush at Sinis Cross were entrained for a number of months. Indeed, we have testimony of James Jim Lahey from Callan, who was leader of the West Kilkenny Flying Column. He had visited Munkine in order to make plans to attack this same patrol in April 1921, just 2 months previously. Lahey and his vice commandant at the time, Ned Elward, had been asked to come down by Pat the Builder Welch, also known as Big Pat Welch, captain of the Clogher IRA Company, known as C Company. By the way, the Builder Welches are where the Quilties are now in Clogher, if anyone knows that area. However, Lahey was left in no uncertain terms that the Munkine men wanted to do this one for themselves and in their own time. In Lahey's own words, he said, quote, Ned Elward told me that he had been asked by Pat Welch of Clogher to bring down 5 or 6 riflemen, as Welch considered that there was a good chance of ambushing a police patrol on the road between Fidown. We set out for Clogher from Callan and reached it on the third night. Pat Welch took us to Bardens of Canaspic, which was more remote than Clogher, where the beds had been put up for us on a loft over the outhouse. The next night, Elward went with Pat Welch to attend a meeting of the company where arrangements for the ambush were to be made. On his return, Elward said, "We had better get away from here, Jimmy. We are not wanted in this district. Pat Welch is all right, but the others don't want any trouble around here." We left next morning, but were not more than half a mile away when Bardens was surrounded and searched by the British military from Waterford, accompanied by IRC men from the local stations. On our way back, we stayed the night at O'Shea's in Mullinbeg. End quote. What we can gather from this account is what was happening generally with IRA units all over Ireland, in that they were pretty much acting independently and making their own decisions and plans. Obviously, Pat Welch was happy to have the Flying Column help them out and invited them down, but when the whole 9th Battalion staff and captains met, it was decided they would prefer to do this ambush themselves, in their own time. Nedda Elward had insisted at the meeting that the local men could keep any guns that were captured. Getting decent weapons and arms was a constant struggle for IRA combatants during the War of Independence. It was often a point of conflict between the different brigades and battalions in Ireland at the time, hence why Elward made the offer to the Munkine men. Either way, the 9th Battalion were happier doing things on their own terms, as they knew the lay of the land and were prepared to suffer any of the repercussions that would come their way as a result. I will just mention at this juncture that the Welsh surname, and it's Welsh, not Walsh, is so common in Munkine and South Kilkenny generally that I will need to use family nicknames to distinguish the different families. So just as we need to use family nicknames on the different Brennan families in North Kilkenny, for instance, we also need to use them on the Welsh family names of South Kilkenny. Just as an example of this, although there was only about 20 plus men in the main ambush party at Zinnet's Cross, there was actually two Pat Welshes taking part who were not closely related. That's Big Pat Welsh of the Builder Welshes and Pat the Fox Welsh of the Swithin or Rishteen Welshes. Now back to our story at hand. In the lead up to the Zinnet's Cross ambush, it was necessary to stir up a bit of trouble in the locality, so to speak. In the terminology of the time, it was to draw out the Crown forces. This was to make sure the RIC didn't ease off on their patrols. In other words, to show that the South Kilkenny and Munkine area in particular was, in RIC parlance, a disturbed area, that law and order was breaking down. There are a few instances of this in relation to the weeks before the Zinnet's Cross ambush. It is known that the IRA stole a fancy teapot of all things from Moll Porter of Ardra. She was considered a loyalist, having sons in the British Army even prior to the First World War. Although a tokenistic steal, they knew she would report it to the RIC in Fidown or Kilmacow. In addition to this, the local IRA stole an antique clock from the home of Roger and Mary Mennell, who then owned Clogher Mills. The Mennells were a friendly family of English Quakers who had moved to the area some 10 years previously. They were sociable with some of the newly arrived Crown forces, and it was likely they would also report the break-in. Indeed, it was a running joke locally for years after the War of Independence, where former old IRA members would be jibed, "Ah lads, the trouble is all over now, would you ever give back that clock?" Indeed, my family must be guilty of playing some part in this horological thievery, as my father, uncles and aunts used to play with the same said antique clock decades later, which was hidden in a loft over a stable. The final part of the effort to harass the Fidown RIC occurred just 4 nights before the Zinnet's Cross ambush. On Tuesday night, the 14th of June 1921, members of the Clogher IRA Company, led by Big Pat Welsh, set fire to Fidown Bridge, which was then a wooden structure which spanned the river shore across the County Waterford. It was a daring thing to do, as it was only a few hundred yards from the RIC barracks in Fidown. Not only would it garner headlines to give publicity to the disturbed nature of South Kilkenny, but it would also cut off a route for reinforcements that may be called for during the ambush. The next nearest bridges across the wide expanse of the river shore were in Carrick-on-Shore and Waterford City. The gatekeeper was locked inside his house while this happened, as to not allow him to raise the alarm. There was a toll to cross the Fidown Bridge at this time, hence the presence of the gatekeeper. But despite requisitioning petrol from the village, the wooden structure was too damp and failed to ignite sufficiently. The bridge remained passable, although there was a decent amount of damage done, with compensation of £186 requested to repair it. By the way, that bridge was partially destroyed during the Civil War. Now, just to describe the ambush plan as it was set out. It was to take place at a slight bend in the road just after crossroads at Zinnet's Cross. It was a relatively good position, with boreens and lanes running off it for escape purposes. There was some decent cover in the ditches and fields surrounding it too, much more than would appear the case today. This area of South Kilkenny was fairly fertile and flat in the plain of the Shore Valley, so there was few advantageous locations in the line of hilly terrain where the RIC could be attacked more easily. As stated previously, the overall leader that day was Jack McCullough Welsh of Portnoscully Mills, he being the overall commander of the 9th Battalion. However, it appears Jack wisely left the preparations on the ground, so to speak, to those most familiar with Clogher and the Tubberd areas. Jack was from the other side of Munkine, nearly 7 kilometres away from Zinnet's Cross, so it was Big Pat Welsh of Clogher, Ted Moore of Rathkirby and Dick Brennan of Knockanure who did the minute details of the planning. In addition, the leaders were very fortunate to have two members of the IRA who had fought in the British Army during the First World War just 2 years previously. These were James the Soldier Welch and Phil White John Hennebery, who were the only two men of the ambush party who had real world combat experience and expertise. Indeed, the 9th Battalion quartermaster, that was Ted Moore, would later recall that if it hadn't been for Hennebery and Welch's military experience during the ambush, all might have been lost. The 9th Battalion, like most of the IRA battalions at the time, had little or no ammunition or decent weapons. They only had shotguns to take on the heavily armed Crown Forces, who of course had the more lethal rifles to hand. Normal shotgun cartridges just sprayed small pellets, usually to hunt birds and rabbits. The ammo therefore had to be improvised to make them more accurate and deadly. Thus, they made their own buckshot cartridges. This they did by mixing extra gunpowder into the shotgun cartridge and putting in cut-up steel nails and metal, all stuck together with wax. This had two distinct benefits. It made the bullets go a much further distance than regular pellet bullets, and it also gave the bullets a more fixed or concentrated trajectory, more like slug pellets the British would have used. All in all, this made the average shotgun much more deadly and accurate. These ad hoc bullets would regularly be described by the Crown Forces as dum-dum bullets to disparage their Irish foes. Dum-dum bullets had been banned internationally from military warfare as they caused a loss of damage. In order to hide the ammunition prior to the ambush, Jack Larissey, that's of Larissey's shop in Clogher, constructed a timber box within which the ammunition was placed and subsequently hidden in a boggy area near Clogher. In later years, Jack would recall that the timber he had used was from his shop and had the words Larissey's shop printed on it. If the British ever found the box, they wouldn't have had too far to look. Most of those taking part in the actual ambush were aged in their 20s. It spanned from 21-year-old Ned Foran and Michael Welch to Big Pat Welch, who was the oldest at 31. Jack Nicola Welch was 27. The scouts and helpers were mostly in their teens. On the evening before the ambush, Jack Larissey was assisted by a young Mick O'Shea, who later worked in Clogher Mill, in bringing the box of ammunition from the bogs to a safe location near the ambush site. At the age of 17, Shea must have been one of the youngest to have had a direct involvement. So, in the early hours of Saturday, the 18th of June 1921, those taking part in the Sinner's Cross ambush began arriving promptly. They all had to be there by 3 a.m. Being the week of the longest day of the year, sunrise would be very early and they would need to be in their positions early to avoid being seen by anyone passing on the road. The Crown Force Patrol was expected to arrive before lunchtime or earlier. The leaders immediately held a meeting to finalise their strategy. Jack Nicola wanted to station some additional men down a small boreen, which ran approximately 100 yards away from the ambush site on the left-hand side, this lay net to Dunphy's farmhouse. He wanted men there in order to broaden out the ambush area and to ensure that the British would have nowhere to run once the shooting started. In an interview years later, he said, quote, "We neglected one position. It was a boreen going up from the road. They left its position unoccupied, although I wanted to occupy it when I arrived at the ambush site. The others were afraid that someone up this boreen could be seen by people passing the way." End quote. It was a catch-22 situation either way. It may have broadened the ambush site, but it could also have alerted outsiders to the planned ambush. As we've seen already in other planned ambushes around County Kilkenny, Crown Forces getting wind of an ambush usually led to disaster from an IRA's perspective. Scouts were positioned along the road before and after the ambush site to keep a vigilant eye for anyone passing. Through the use of signalling and specific noises, they could alert those nearest to them of any danger. This would be passed further along up the line to the ambush position. Even the scouts would have had to keep deadly silent in the ditch. They could not smoke or laugh, as any sound would give them away. One factor in the ambushers' favour was the extremely mild weather. Kilkenny, and indeed most of Ireland, was experiencing drought-like conditions in what was one of the hottest and driest spring and summers on record up to that point. Thus, despite all the nervousness and anxiety that were undoubtedly everyone was feeling, at least they were not getting wet. But by the early afternoon, at 2:30 p.m, after nearly 12 hours at the ambush site, the IRA started to think the Black and Tan Patrol was not coming that day. They were starving by this stage and just received some much needed sustenance from Jim Malone of Canaspic and Patsy Fitzgerald of Lacan. Martin Muffery of Grange, one of the IRA men that day, described what happened then. Patsy Fitz brought two or three buckets of tea down to us. We enjoyed the tea as we were out all night and day without a bite. We were in the middle of the tea when the scouts who were out on duty gave the signal that the Tans were coming. We left the tea immediately. We rushed to our positions. The Tans came along. End quote. So what actually happened next was that at approximately 2:45 p.m, six black and tans travelling in pairs on bicycles came along towards the ambush position. RAC Constable Patrick Wynne was in charge of them. A seventh black and tan was having problems with the chain of his bike and had dismounted to fix it just before St. Cross. Luckily for him, as it turned out, the ambush was meant to go like this. The IRA would wait until the Tans cycled into the middle of the ambush position. When the last RAC man was in sight, one of the IRA, Dick Brennan of Knockanure, was to fire the first shot, thus giving the signal to the rest of the men to begin shooting. Brennan was positioned with two other men in a small barine right at the start of the ambush position, just over the brow of a little hill, which is actually a small bridge over a stream which passes near Sinnott's Cross. This barine no longer exists and was by the ditch where a little orchard is located today. However, just as Brennan pulled his trigger, the gun jammed. While he was desperately trying to fire the weapon, the British cycled casually through the ambush area. After a few moments of uncertainty, Pat Fox Welch, Swinton Welches of Clogher, realised that Brennan was unable to fire and he took the initiative himself. He raised a shotgun and fired, thus giving the signal for the rest of the men to fire. A hail of bullets then flew from the ditches at the unfortunate British forces on their bikes. One black and tan, Albert Bradford, was hit and knocked off his bike in the initial shots. The Crown forces then sped through the ambush area as quick as they could and took the first bit of cover they could find. This was at Dunphy's Lane. It's the first left after the ambush site today, coming from the Fidown direction and about 150 yards or 140 metres up the road. They went up the lane and established a defensive position. While the British were settling into the lane, the IRA saw that one soldier was lying on the road, hit by a bullet. Phil White, John Hennebury and Ted Moore jumped over the ditch and ran to him. He had been fatally wounded but had not yet succumbed. As he struggled to free his legs from the frame of his bicycle, the two rebels cut the rifle strap from his shoulder and captured his rifle. Ted Moore was the quartermaster of the entire 9th Battalion area, so would have been responsible for looking after any captured arms or ammunition. Both the men escaped back into the ditch. The black and tans began to shoot back from their defensive position. They even fired rifle grenades on top of the ambushers, but they could not actually see them, so they missed their targets. The land here had much more scrub and furze bushes than is the case today, so there would have been a decent amount of cover. Jack McCullough said afterwards that the IRA did not fire back towards Dunphy's, as their buckshot cartridges would probably not reach that distance accurately and thus would be ineffective. The IRA didn't have one rifle between them just because they couldn't be got. By the way, guns jamming during this era was very common. Many IRA, including most of those at Sinnott's Cross, were using the improvised buckshot bullets we talked about previously. This ammo often got stuck in the breech. It's also possible some of the gunpowder used was damp, as it was stored outdoors for a period and so would not ignite when fired. Indeed, Martin Murphy said subsequently that nearly all the shotguns used during the Sinnott's Cross ambush were useless afterwards, as the makeshift ammo had damaged them so badly. Now that the element of surprise was gone and the Crown forces had regrouped, the IRA knew they would have to make a tactical retreat. They had planned this well in advance. One group travelled south towards Monkine through the fields, another would go northwards towards Canaspic Church direction, another would go east in the direction of Kilmacow. Their guns, including the newly captured rifle, were left in an arms dump near a ditch close by for later retrieval. If any IRA man was captured with a gun in the escape, it could mean a sentence of death, so they had to be careful. The men who escaped up the glen towards Canaspic Church were led by Dick Brennan. They suddenly found themselves fired upon by one black and tan who had been straggling behind the rest of the patrol. He had heard the shooting and hid while the fracas continued. However, when the firing stopped, he came out of hiding and spotted the IRA men making their escape. He started shooting down at the men who were travelling up the glen along by the stream. He was too far away to be effective, however, and soon gave up the chase. For the IRA, under the command of Big Pat Welch, there was to be an even greater shock. As mentioned above, the Black and Tans had two patrols in the area, one of which travelled to Clogher from Fidown and the other which came from Kilmacow. Big Pat's IRA group were making their escape in the Ardra-Kilmacow direction when they nearly stumbled into the pass of the Kilmacow RSE patrol. In the words of Martin Murphy, quote, "All our lads got away in different directions. Some went in the direction of Mankind. I went in the Kilmacow direction under Pat Welsh. We had to cross the Kilmacow police patrol's track that was taking them to Clogha, and we had only barely crossed when the police patrol swept along and we had to throw ourselves down on the ground to avoid being seen. End quote. Meanwhile, the Black and Tans back at Sinless Cross commandeered a creamery lorry which just happened to be passing on its way to Clogha Creamery. The remains of the now deceased RIC man Albert Bradford were initially brought to Menel's house of Clogha Mills. Jack Nicholas Welsh later told the story that a local man was passing along the road half drunk. "I never saw a tan or policeman shot before," he said. "I must go in and see him." He went into Clogha Mills and they kicked the living stuffing out of him. End quote. It was also said by locals in later years that when the Crown Forces were at Clogha Mill, they fired a large amount of ammo underneath a nearby bridge. It is likely they fired into thin air in order to use up some of their bullets, as to be in a position to claim that they had fought in a much bigger battle than they actually had. This was a way to avoid further embarrassments, especially since one of their men had been killed and another had been wounded. Later that evening, the Black and Tans left Clogha Mills and returned to Fidown with the body of their deceased comrade. The Black and Tan, who was mortally wounded during the ambush, died within 10 minutes of the attack beginning due to a loss of blood. He'd been hit a number of times in the right side of the abdomen and a vein or artery had been severed. His name was Albert Lawrence Bradford, who was from Rose Lane, Chesterford, Essex in England. He was 23 years old at the time. Bradford had joined the Black and Tans 10 months before Sinnott's Cross on the 31st of August 1920 and was assigned to County Kilkenny. He was employed as a casual labourer before coming to Ireland. Bradford's sergeant that day, Constable Patrick Wynne, gave a statement to the Crown Force military inquiry that investigated Bradford's death. It took place in Fidown RIC barracks the day after the Sinnott's Cross ambush, that's on Sunday the 19th of June. In it, Constable Wynne described what occurred from the Crown Force's point of view. Quote, "At about 2:45 p.m. I was proceeding along the Fidown Clogha Road in charge of a party of seven constables. Near Sinnott's Cross we were fired on. We rode on past the spot from which the fire was proceeding, dismounted and attacked the ambushers in extended order. I already had two men hit. When the action was over, I returned to the scene of the ambush and found the deceased, Albert Lawrence Bradford, lying on his back in a water cuss along the road," that's a water drain or dike, "moaning and working one of his legs up and down. He told me that he was dying and wanted a drink of water. I told Constable McCahy to look after him while I went away to improvise a stretcher at a neighbouring carpenter shop. When I got back, Bradford was dead." End quote. Constable James McCahy also gave his version of events to the inquiry. Quote, "I saw Constable Bradford lying on his back in a water table beside the road. He was groaning and moving his legs. He asked for a drink and for Steve, by whom he meant Constable Grogan. I opened his clothes and saw his wounds were very serious. He died a few minutes later and not more than 10 minutes after the first shots were fired." End quote. In a coincidental twist of fate, just as Bradford was taking his last breaths in Mankind before 3 p.m. that day, at the other end of the county, IRA man Nicholas Mullins was passing away in Castlecomer due to the injuries he had sustained at the Coolbawn ambush that very same afternoon. It underscores the tragedies of war with the loss of two young men in the prime of their lives at the exact same time. The Sinnott's Cross ambush had a strange follow-up as well. The evening afterwards, the body of Albert Bradford was moved from Fidown Barracks to Carrick-on-Shore Military Barracks. From here, his body was to be brought to Cork or Waterford for transporting back to Essex. However, the Crossley tender escorting Bradford's remains was alleged to have been ambushed on the new bridge in Carrick-on-Shore, which is still the main bridge we know today across towards Carrickbeg. One soldier of the Devonshire Regiment, 28-year-old Private William Smith, was killed, having a bullet wound to the head. It is likely that it was an accidental killing, however. It appears that it was Smith's own weapon or one of the weapons of his comrades which inadvertently went off when the lorry clipped the wall coming onto the bridge. The soldiers, of course, would have had their weapons at the ready when out in the open like that. So-called friendly fire incidents were all too common during this era on both sides. If the IRA had been involved in some way, they would have had no problem in acknowledging it. It was the Crown Forces who released a statement saying Smith had met his end when a funeral convoy was ambushed. This was likely released to show the IRA in a bad light. In propaganda terms, the incidents of that weekend were disaster for the Crown Forces. There was now two members of the Crown Forces dead, another was injured, and not one IRA man was even arrested. Indeed, it is noteworthy in terms of the propaganda regarding the Sinless Cross ambush, even though this was a complete failure for the Crown Forces, their public statements into the matter included positive spin, such as the rebels were driven off with his believed casualties to them, while also stating that 5 guns and 200 rounds of ammunition were captured. These statements were totally false, as the IRA suffered no casualties, while they did not possess that quantity of ammunition to begin with. Also, as we heard early, besides Bradford, another black and tan was hit and wounded at Sinless Cross. He was 26-year-old John Charles Stewart. Some months after the ambush, he brought a case for compensation for his injuries before Thomastown Courthouse. Monkine, by the way, was in the Thomastown District for court cases at the time. The journalist reporting on this case stated that Stewart spoke with a strong Scottish accent. It was recorded that Stewart said at the trial that he, quote, received a wound in the upper part of the left arm. It was a shotgun wound and a number of pellets entered his arm. On the night of the ambush, he was taken to the Waterford Military Hospital after having first been attended by Dr. Quirk of Piltown. After a day in the military hospital, he was transferred to the civilian hospital where he was under the care of Dr. Morrissey. As a result of the injuries, he had no grip with his left hand. He could not straighten the arm and was unable to turn his left wrist. He joined up the British Army in November 1914 and had served throughout the war until 1919 when he was discharged. End quote. The judge then asked, did he escape France without a wound? He replied that he had just been wounded in the left ankle in March 1918 as all, so Sinless Cross had proved a lot more dangerous. Prior to joining the Black and Tans, Stewart worked as a bookbinder and printer, for which he had fully completed his apprenticeship. Because of his injuries, he was discharged from the RIC and he said he would probably not be able to work again as a printer. Dr. Morrissey, in his evidence, stated that there was 3 large wounds which went through the back of the arm and came out in the front. As a result of the wounds, the nerve was injured, hence why he could not turn his left wrist or expand the left elbow. Stewart was getting electrical shock and massage treatment to help the injuries, but it was unclear if it would heal sufficiently. Stewart was eventually awarded £2,000 in compensation for his wounds received at Sinless Cross. In the aftermath of the Sinless Cross ambush, there was a huge fear around Clogha and Monkine generally that reprisals by the Crown Forces would follow. In other parts of the country, businesses and farmsteads were set alight. Crown Forces swept the area for information on the IRA party who had carried out the ambush. The threat went out that every house in Clogha would be burned to the ground unless information was forthcoming. The local IRA who had participated in the ambush tried to act as normal as possible, hiding in plain sight, so to speak, so as to not arouse suspicion, so they went around their daily farming tasks. In my family's lore, James the Soldier Welsh often recounted the story that he was bringing cattle up the new line in Clogha in the days after the ambush when he was stopped and searched by Black and Tans, completely forgetting he still had bullets in his jacket pockets. Having any kind of material like that was an offence in martial law era Kilkenny. However, he managed to blag his way out of it, saying he was one of them having fought in the British Army during the First World War, which of course was true. He just didn't tell them that he had switched sides since then. The following story was relayed by one of Monkine's oldest inhabitants in 2003, John Kinsler of Cloncunny, who has since sadly passed away. In later life, John actually lived in Clogha and worked in Clogha Creamery, but as an 11-year-old boy, he witnessed directly the repercussions of the Sinless Cross ambush, which he retold with the utmost clarity even all those years later. Quote, about half an hour after the ambush, the soldiers came into our house in Cloncunny. My father had a man painting a hay barn. He was standing on some scaffolding. The soldiers came in and shook him down from the scaffolding and hit him with a rifle butt. Then the soldier, possibly the same one, hit my brother Mikey in the mouth with a grenade and broke his lip and some teeth. There was a girl in the house at the time called May Welsh. She was visiting from England and had a slight English accent. When she saw how the soldiers were behaving towards the men, she shouted at them, "Oh, you pig, you mustn't hit him, he's only 16. Then she told the soldiers, "We are English and we are going to complain about you when we get back." The English soldier replied, "F you and England." He grabbed her by the ponytail and swung her around and hit her on the back of the neck with his rifle. End quote. It would also appear that Roger Mennell, the local mill owner, did a lot to calm tensions. He had been friendly with the Crown Forces who used to pass his road every day. Remember, he hadn't been treated too well by the IRA who stole his clock. But he sincerely promised the Crown Forces that none of the local men were involved in the fighting and that it was an outside flying column that came into the area and carried out the ambush. Now, we don't know if he was just trying to quell tensions or perhaps he was just sticking up for his customers and neighbours, many of whom who would have been from the Clogher area. The Mennell family, having had enough of Irish politics, subsequently left and emigrated to Tasmania in 1924, a long way from Sinnott's Cross. Luckily for everyone, the truce came into effect on the 11th of July 1921, just 3 weeks after the Sinnott's Cross ambush. By the way, Clogher Mill House is still there today, and Clogher Creamery and Fadown RIC barracks are now in use as private dwelling houses. So just to conclude, in purely military terms, although small in nature, this was an entirely successful ambush from the IRA's point of view. The element of surprise was the key to its success. It could have been even worse for the Crown Forces if the IRA hadn't such primitive weapons. No IRA or Cumann na mBan members were killed, captured or even arrested because of the ambush. There was no big reprisals. In addition, because a member of the Crown Forces was killed, it made the local and national media, which reinforced the narrative that the British government was losing control of rural Ireland, considering there was a deadly ambush in what was up till then a relatively quiet part of the country. During the truce period, some weeks after the Sinnott's Cross ambush, Dick Brennan sent a report of the ambush to the Kilkenny Brigade OC, or officer commanding of the whole of County Kilkenny, who was George O'Dwyer from Coon, just for his records. In this, Brennan listed 17 members of the local IRA who took part in the Sinnott's Cross ambush, while Jack Nicuilla listed another 4, bringing the total to 21. Now note that this does not include all the scouts who participated, or all the help and assistance that was given by Cumann na mBan or other locals before and after the ambush. The men listed were Jack and Ed Nicuilla Welsh of Portna Scully Mill in Carrigeen, the brothers Dick and Michael Brennan of Knockanure, Ted Moore of Ratcorby, Eddie Doyle and Eddie Dunphy of Luffany, Big Pat Welsh of the Builder Welshes of Clogha, my own 3 granduncles, the Welsh brothers Pat the Fox, James the Soldier and Michael Hickey Welsh of the Swinton Welshes of Clogha. Also from Clogha were Mick Shea and Willie Lawler, from Grange came Martin Murphy. In addition, Tom Fitzgerald of Lecon, Ned Barden of Kilnaspic, Phil White, John Hennebry of Dernan, Tommy Morlan of Clamore, Ned Foran of Adra, Dick Carl of Dungooly, and finally Dick Delahunty of Corramartin. Now he's a relative of the rebel priest Father Pat Delahunty of Callan, who would break out of jail later in 1921. Some of those who took part in the Sinnott's Cross ambush also took part in the proceeding civil war. Indeed, less than 12 months later, Dick Brennan and Ted Moore were part of the anti-treaty side which took over Kilkenny Castle during the Battle of Kilkenny in May 1922. Brennan later immigrated to America. James the Soldier Welsh also immigrated to the US and did not return to Ireland. In addition, two of the men who took part in the Sinnott's Cross ambush went on to play for the Kilkenny senior hurling team, Eddie Doyle and Eddie Dunphy. Indeed, Eddie Doyle captained Kilkenny to their 10th All-Ireland victory in Croke Park 12 years later in September 1933. This included the added bonus of a trip to America. He died at the relatively young age of 51 in 1948. Some of the others, like Big Pat the Builder Welsh, Jack Nicuilla Welsh, Martin Murphy, Phil Hennebry, Ted Moore, lived out the rest of their lives in Munkine Parish. Pat the Fox Welsh lived most of his life in the UK, having moved there in the 1920s. He was likely the last surviving participant of the Sinnott's Cross ambush to pass away when he died in 1987 at the age of 90. The mostly young people who participated in the independence movement of this era had nothing to gain in the short or even long term, but perhaps had a lot to lose. The losses could have included their farms, their jobs, their family's safety, their freedom, or even their own lives. I doubt any of them wanted to be involved in violence and attacks, but they obviously felt that this war, which had come to their door for the cause of freedom, was a just and worthy cause in their eyes. And I think that's a good place to finish today. Just to thank you all once again for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's podcast. And don't forget to join your local library to avail of all the fabulous free resources. Until next time, thanks.